Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kahlberg. Our theme song was performed by Joe Clement. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital and capitalism, getting down in the dirt of the grassroots to root that mountain down and make a clean start. On today's show, we'll hear about cleaning up, about the ways that capital cleans up monetarily at the expense of making a mess of the world, about the ways that dirt and trees can help us clean the air, about the ways that people can use shared knowledge, collective action, and legal and political strategies to clean up the messes that capital and its agents make in the world. We'll start today's show with a conversation among Bill Resnick, Guy Berliner, and Bevan Burns of the Brooklyn Neighborhood Association about air quality in Portland, which is even worse than you probably thought, and about the things that folks are doing to compel government agencies to come clean and to clean it up, including a town hall this Wednesday, September 26th, about diesel pollution. Then we'll hear from Desiree Hellegers interviewing activist Catherine Stauffer about the long cleanup of the mess that was made back in the 90s by the right-wing Oregon Citizens Alliance. They talk about the climate of homophobic and white supremacist terror in Oregon in the early 1990s, about Stauffer's historic role in infiltrating the Oregon Citizens Alliance, and in the protracted lawsuit that bankrupted the OCA, and about links to the SPLC lawsuit that bankrupted the white Aryan resistance following the 1988 murder of Mulugeta Sarraw. Then Bill returns to talk about the Eco Film Festival coming up this weekend, starting Thursday, September 27th at the Hollywood Theater. He interviews festival organizer Dawn Smallman and filmmaker Marcelina Cravat, whose documentary Dirt Rich examines geotherapy strategies for carbon drawdown to help clean the atmosphere of greenhouse gases. Finally, we turn to the mess of grief, which rarely offers a clean break. Bookmole Larry Bolden will be with us to discuss Colm Tobin's 2014 novel, Nora Webster. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook, to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Bill Resnick, Bevan Burns, and Guy Berliner talking about air pollution in Portland.
Bevan Burns and Guy Berliner, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Bill.
Bevan Burns is a school principal in downtown Portland. Guy Berliner is by day a software programmer, and in the rest of the time a community activist with Portland Tenants United and other social justice organizations, as well as the Brooklyn Neighborhood Association. Both are very active and in clean air struggles, and particularly in stopping diesel pollution that is particularly dangerous in very high concentrations in our allegedly green city of Portland, Oregon. They are now organizing for a town hall this Wednesday addressing diesel pollution, inviting the whole city and universe to their town hall. Devin, tell us about Portland Clean Air Coalition that you're very active in and your town hall.
Well, Portland Clean Air is a nonprofit organization really serving to collect science and provide data in order to empower citizens throughout the city to take action on air pollution issues. I got involved with the organization as a principal of a school serving special needs kids considered by the EPA to be sensitive receptors. We were downwind from a big polluter, a couple of oil re-refineries. Getting involved, I was really shocked to learn just how bad the air here in Portland is. We have this idea that we live in this pristine, green, privileged city of breathing green air, clean air, and all the green spaces that we have. And when I started really looking at the data and learning the science, that in fact Portland has the worst air in the nation in terms of people suffering from respiratory distress from air pollution, and we are among between the second and fifth percent, depending on neighborhoods, in how high our diesel particulate pollution is compared to the rest of the nation, I was shocked and disgusted and motivated to get involved. So I work with Portland Clean Air to help collaborate and coordinate communication between 12 different neighborhood associations in North and Northeast. There's several volunteers playing this role, coordinating more than 30 neighborhood associations throughout Portland with a reach to over 50,000 residents, really focused on this sole issue of helping us all breathe easier.
Guy Berliner, you've developed a tremendous amount of knowledge about diesel pollution, that fascinating and inspiring subject.
Correct.
Tell us about what's happening in Portland.
Yeah, I was shocked also to learn that the problem is as serious as it is. The neighborhood that I live in, Brooklyn, is affected by the UP rail yards in particular and the trains there that idle 24/7. But we also have a lot of short-haul trucks, and most of them, the great majority of them, have no modern emissions controls. Now, we know that this problem has been around for a while, but it's compounded by the fact that neighboring states like California and Washington have been a lot more proactive in dealing with it. So, for example, in California, already in 2015, by law, they phased out all older, more polluting diesel trucks. And as a consequence, unfortunately, Oregon is now a dumping grounds for their dirty diesel equipment that we can't operate here anymore.
And tell us about diesel, why it's so dangerous. I had no idea how dangerous diesel pollution was in the whole picture. There's a lot of air pollution anyway.
Yep.
People are breathing noxious stuff. But
that's
diesel
right.
is so deadly.
Well, you're right, Bill. The problem, I think, with diesel is that more than anything, it's omnipresent. There's probably pollutants out there that are more acute dangers very close to people who are breathing them. But there's nothing that is as omnipresent and contains as many dangerous toxins that we're all getting exposed to as diesel. If you're anywhere within a few hundred feet of a major arterial freeway and so on, you're getting exposed to dangerous levels of diesel in our metro area. Not to mention if you're anywhere near a construction site. Construction sites tend to have equipment that produces diesel emissions absolutely off the charts. And so it's an enormous problem. And the diesel particulates are so tiny that they bypass your alveoli, they pass straight into your bloodstream, they're carried to all your vital organs. And so, you know, we've got an article just came out a week ago, a lead article in the Washington Post, that implicates diesel heavily in incidence of dementia. And they're estimating a cost annually to our economy in terms of dementia care of something on the order of $300 billion. So this is a cost that's being imposed on our society every year, and diesel is the leading factor that we know of, environmental factor, that seems to be responsible, heavily implicated in causing dementia in older adults.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bevan Byrne and Guy Berliner, who are citizen activists. They're doing a town hall this Wednesday, September 26th at 7 p.m., I guess, at the
Sacred Heart Church, 3910 Southeast 11th Avenue in the Brooklyn neighborhood.
Right. They're doing a town hall organizing, and it's being sponsored by Portland Clean Air Coalition, but also all of the neighborhood, many of the neighborhood associations.
Yeah, in fact, Bill, it was the initiative of the neighborhood associations by themselves to do this, and Portland Clean Air has helped us with developing outreach and so on, but it was really our initiative and our decision to bring together people from all over the city to this neighborhood and this meeting where we're going to have a panel of electeds and candidates for office, and we hope that this is an opportunity to corner them and ask them, what are they going to do about this problem before the elections that are upcoming?
It seems to me that both the EPA at the national level and the DEQ in the state, and in fact our whole apparatus, has been misleading us with numbers that don't really tell the story.
I think you're right, Bill. I think that the DEQ seems to have a modus operandi of demobilizing and disarming the public, and we see that repeatedly. It's a repeated pattern. You know, we see that in their handling of the giant Cully tire fire that they terribly fumbled, as people know who read the major expose done by Rachel Monahan in the Willy Week. We see that in their handling of the Boardman plant and their mercury emissions, which they tried to minimize falsely. And we see that in the way that they report numbers when it comes to diesel pollution, because they deliberately use a color coding chart that indicates that any level below what they label as 100 on the air quality index is safe, is not of any concern. Whereas we know that levels that are far lower than that are responsible for these long-term devastating diseases.
I think that's one of the main issues, is in how we're setting health standards in our city and our state compared to others around the nation. Our bar is too low, and it's not showing the value that we have in humans. When we're in another big piece, is they're not looking at cumulative effect. And when you're looking at those numbers, you're looking at one isolated sampling that does not take into effect the cumulative effect and all of those others over a long stretch of time. And quite honestly, there's just too little data. There is not enough diesel particulate monitoring happening. And really, it's coming to the people to take up that charge now.
Yeah, exactly, Bevan. They don't even have a station anywhere near my neighborhood of Brooklyn. And we have strong reason to believe that Brooklyn is a hot spot because of the rail yards, the locomotives that idle 24/7, and all the short-haul route trucks. They don't have a station anywhere within less than 3 or 4 miles of our neighborhood, and that just doesn't seem to make sense.
And you did have some monitoring of it, which show very dangerous levels. There's really a reason. There's a lot of smoke, and there probably is a fire. Is that correct?
Yes. We do have sensor data that has been taken by Dr. Linda George, environmental scientist from PSU, and it does seem to indicate that there is real cause for concern. That's actual sensor data and not just models.
Again, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Bevan Byrne and Guy Berliner. We're talking about diesel pollution in Portland, its tremendous dangers for public health. And now we're going to switch gears a little bit. This is all, it's absolutely unnecessary. It could be dealt with very easily. Other states have done it. It's shocking, the power of the trucking, the low-end trucking industry in this state, who are sort of cleaning up making money off of public health, buying the cheapest trucks and charging market rates, and therefore doing well, and they seem to own the legislature, and even the Portland City Council is pretending to do something about it.
Exactly.
Let's talk about what could be done and what they're doing.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Bill. If you go back all the way to 2004, 14 years ago, the New York City Council under Mayor Bloomberg enacted a public law 77 under which they phased out over approximately 1 to 2 year period all dirty diesel from public contracts, and they mandated a best available technology standard for any diesel engines used in public contract work. Now, that was done, again, in 2004, Whereas what we have today is a city council here in Portland, which is now considering enacting an ordinance in December, which will phase in a rule for contracts to use cleaner diesel technology, which is great, but over a 7-year period. And I'm not sure I understand how that happens. How do we wind up getting a 7-year phase-in, whereas New York City has a phase-in over apparently about a year?
Well, California also...
Yeah, California has enacted not just a contracting standard, but a statewide mandatory requirement to phase out all dirty diesel engines in their entire trucking fleet across the state. And that actually went into effect in 2015.
And as a result, they've lowered diesel emissions by 95%.
By 95%?
Yes. It's huge.
And modern emissions controls that are mandated on all vehicles by the EPA post-2007 will remove some 99-point-something percent of the diesel particulates. So the technology has been around already for decades. It's off the shelf.
And it can't be that expensive just to put in some new engines that are going to run for 1,000,000 miles when you amortize the cost of it. It's like,
well, look, Bill, I mean, it's expensive because it costs money to overhaul a vehicle fleet, but it's pretty cheap relative to the costs that we're talking about in public health. Again, if you cite, for example, the Washington Post article that came out a week ago, just the costs to this entire country in terms of dementia care alone for older adults is on the order of between $200 and $300 billion every single year. For less than that cost, you could probably overhaul the entire diesel fleet of all of North America.
Yes, at minimum, and not to mention the human misery that it's causing.
Well, of course.
And the debility. People should come to the town hall, get active in the neighborhood association, and ultimately, there's a variety of ways of dealing with the problem. There's lawsuits could be maintained. There's the state. The city, though, is... We really are the biggest polluter in some ways. You have one final thing you want to say, Guy?
Yeah, I think that Bevan's project with her kids is a great example of what citizens can do about this problem, and it shows the power of citizens taking their own initiative.
Yeah, Bevan, tell us a little bit about it, and then tell us about the town hall.
Absolutely. I'm very excited about the class we're doing at Bridges. I'm working with students, a small group of students, and a friend of mine, Chris Eichamp, here locally, another air quality advocate, who has developed a way to put the power in citizen hands to be able to do diesel particulate monitoring. He's invented a low-cost, self-buildable model where people can monitor diesel particulate in their own homes and neighborhoods. What I'm doing with our kids in a class is we are actually building these sensors called sensor bots using recycled materials. We will be placing them at our school and at our student neighborhood homes, and then we will be tracking the diesel particulate monitoring live time, looking and comparing and contrasting the difference between our location in downtown Portland versus their neighborhood residential programs. We will be looking for anomalies within that. If we see big spikes, we will be looking for trends and what might cause that. And we're also looking at what we can do about it. So our kids will be writing state and city elected officials. They will be writing media outlets. They will be writing to TriMet or C-Tran, who idle their buses for hours in front of our playground every day. And they will also be writing the parents of our school, who idle their cars in our parking lot, and putting up signs that show, please turn your car off, small lungs at work. These are their ideas. And as they began to learn about pollution, where it comes from, and what they can do, they've already sprung into action. So I'm really excited partnering with Chris to be able to monitor this data. And it is real diesel particulate monitoring of particulates of PM2, 5, and smaller, which is difficult. And he's come up with a great way to do that, where citizens can, for a very affordable and easy way to do this get data with the goal of being able to have citizens throughout the city doing this. Unfortunately, this is an example of it's not being done at the state city level, and citizens cannot wait 8 years for things like cleaner technology. So we're taking this into our hands, and we're doing what we can to provide the knowledge to the people in power and demand that they take action, because again, our elected officials work for us, and it's important to remember that. But it takes the people having being empowered with knowledge and being able to take action to motivate them to do so.
You know, why shouldn't 10% of the parents in public schools or other people in neighborhoods set up these monitoring devices in their home? It sounds like they aren't that super expensive to monitor.
They are not that super expensive, and the way he has it set up.
Yeah, I think it's something that we could be doing across the board. The way that the technology works, I think Bevan was going to mention, is that it reports back to a server, and so you can aggregate the data and build a map, a heat map of pollution levels everywhere. And you can figure out, as you said, Bevan, what the trends are. You can figure out what the hot spots are. And this is actionable information.
Yeah. So tell us about the town hall, and then we'll sign off.
So we're really excited about this town hall. The Brooklyn Neighborhood Association has really taken the charge of organizing this and joining a coalition of a citywide coalition of other neighborhood associations. And they've asked me to moderate this, so I'm really excited to be a part of it. We'll have expert presenters in legal and health areas and how diesel particulate is impacting us. And then we will have a panel of 7 elected officials and candidates from state, from city, and from the county. And we will be asking some tough questions and really trying to get a sense of where they are, what they can do, but also looking to hold them to the fire and accountable and working together to find some solutions, not just with themselves, but with the people who are experiencing the health issues daily from this problem. This, I call it one of the most paramount health crises in Portland.
Bevan Byrne, Guy Berliner, thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks Bill, a lot, Bill.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Where's the
Yeah, that was the band Cake doing their tune Carbon Monoxide. And before that, Bill Resnick, Bevan Byrne, and Guy Berliner talking about the town hall on diesel pollution this Wednesday, September 26th at 7 p.m. at the Sacred Heart Church, 3910 Southeast 11th in Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We come to you every Monday at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Bill will return later in the hour with a conversation about the Eco Film Festival coming this weekend at the Hollywood Theater, and we'll hear from book mole Larry Bolden reviewing a novel by Colm Tobin. But next, we have Desiree Helligers talking with activist Catherine Stauffer about her work to infiltrate the virulently homophobic Oregon Citizens Alliance in the lead-up to the historic 1992 defeat of Ballot Measure 9.
As most of our listeners are well aware, this November, Oregon voters will be confronted with 2 ballot measures. Measure 105 would dismantle Oregon's 30-year-old sanctuary state status and open up, particularly immigrants of color, to new forms of state surveillance and targeting. Measure 106 has been termed a backdoor ban on abortion, since the measure would make abortion inaccessible to low-income women in Oregon. As we confront the resurgence of the Christian right and of white supremacy and fascism nationally and in Oregon, it seems like an important time to excavate the intersecting histories in Oregon's fight in the late 1980s and early 1990s against both white supremacist violence and violent homophobic backlash. In the latter case, the Oregon Citizens Alliance loomed large. The Oregon Citizens Alliance, or OCA, ran 3 major ballot campaigns, including Measure 8, which succeeded in rolling back Neil Goldschmidt's executive order banning the state from engaging in discrimination based on sexual orientation. And ballot Measure 8 was enacted in 1988, the same year that Mulageta Serwa, a 28-year-old Ethiopian student attending PSU, was beaten to death by skinheads with ties to an organization known as the White Aryan Resistance, or WAR. Following criminal convictions of Serwa's attackers, in 1990, Serwa's family, represented by the Southern Poverty Law Center, won a $12.5 million settlement against Tom Metzger, the main organizer behind the White Aryan Resistance. The lawsuit effectively ended WAR's reign of terror in Oregon. That same year, my guest, Catherine Stauffer, was assaulted at an OCA event, and in 1992, Stauffer won a civil suit against the OCA in the weeks before Oregonians voted down yet another OCA-initiated measure, Measure 9, which would have amended the state constitution to mandate new statewide regulations discriminating
against gays and lesbians. The measure equated homosexuality with pedophilia, sadism, and masochism. Also in 1990, the OCA mounted Measure 10, which would have required parental permission for abortion for minors. Both measures were defeated.
Listeners who are interested in learning more about this history should definitely check out the website of the Rural Organizing Project, which traces its own roots to this period in Oregon history and the fight against the Christian right and the OCA, a fight in which Pekun was also a key ally. ROP's website also provides context on organizing by ROP, Pekun, and CAUSA to defeat a 1995 anti-immigrant measure. The online Oregon Encyclopedia article on the OCA written by Randy Blasek, who references a wave of anti-gay hate crimes in 1992, including the murders of Hattie Mae Cohen, a 29-year-old lesbian, and Brian H. Mock, a 45-year-old gay man, were both killed in a Salem firebombing. I spoke with Catherine Stauffer this past Friday about her role infiltrating the OCA and her protracted legal battle to effectively bankrupt and neutralize the organization. Stauffer is also featured in a new documentary film on the fight
against Measure 9.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this fight against the OCA?
I moved to Oregon in 1990, and when I got here, I was very interested in researching what was going on with the Christian right. We had a huge problem with an anti-abortion movement. Operation Rescue, Advocates for Life, were really, really organized in the state of Oregon. And I started looking into what they were doing. I had been the editor of my college newspaper. I was only 22 years old. And I was also active with ACT UP. So I started going to events that the anti-abortion movement were organizing. And I came across the discussion about, they had an idea that they were going to sponsor an anti-gay ballot measure. And I was really instantly alarmed. And I kind of went from being someone who wanted to research what was going on to someone who was fairly determined to stop what was going on. I infiltrated them for a year. I managed to collect all kinds of information about them, from who was involved to who was donating funds to what their political strategy was. And I started turning it over to their political enemies. Came from a certain social vantage point, being a young woman. I recognized that older men would brag to me, and I could write down information and then follow up on the phone and really get a lot of information, and that's what I did.
And you were working as a photographer at this point?
Yes, I was also working as a photojournalist for a couple of newspapers in town, including Just Out.
Okay, which has gone under since, but Just Out was a really important purveyor of information that impacted the LGBTQI community in Portland. Yeah.
So I did this for a year, and at some point I figured that they probably knew what I was doing, and I stopped. But they kept me on their membership list, and they sent me an invitation to their premiere screening of the anti-gay video they were going to use in their campaign, taking place in the Four Square Church here in Portland. So they sent me the invitation to that event, and I just sort of figured that at that point they probably knew what I had been doing, but sort of carefully weighed out my options and decided that I would attend this event. They had me on their membership list, clearly their mistake, and I showed up at this event, and then I was accosted by Scott Lively, who's now internationally famous for drumming up the anti-gay sentiment in Uganda and all over the world at this point, and is facing crimes against humanity charges. But he removed me from this church. He picked me up, he threw me into a wall, he dragged me across the church and then out the door and into the gutter. After I had been assaulted by Scott Lively, I decided to sue them with a specific intention of slowing them down. You know, when you sue someone, you can request 2,000 discovery materials. You can cause them a lot of stress, and you can really deplete them of energy, and that was my intention. The year between when they managed to collect the signatures and when this went to the voters was an increasingly stressful time for gay people in Oregon. Even the police chief said that there was an imminent sense of danger in Oregon. The time I went to trial against the OCA, the city was really, really under pressure.
So you infiltrated the group in 1990, you were assaulted in 1991, and then the case went to trial in 1992, just weeks before the vote on this ballot measure 9.
Yeah, it was an incredibly stressful time in Oregon. Organizers were told to stay in groups. The police department actually had different activists assigned police officers. It was a time of real terror for gay people in Oregon when I went to trial. And it was a very stressful trial. But I did win that trial. I mean, I won a judgment from that trial. And I'm not sure what the impact it had on that election, but I walked away from the judgment that was given to me. I won a $31,000 judgment. But I really had only had the intention of slowing the OCA down. It was never my intention to collect the money. And I didn't believe that I could collect the money. So I went away and I had a couple of easy years. But the OCA were symbols of terror in Oregon and attempted to come back a couple more times. And at some point when I was in my late 20s, I realized that I could probably set myself up as a creditor to the OCA and start draining their bank accounts. I could probably sue them to get the money that they owed me. And then it might really politically slow them down, especially if I said that I was a gay rights activist. I thought that it might send them to war with themselves. And it did. That worked. They started returning their campaign donations because they were afraid that they were going to go to a homosexual. And I hauled them into court over and over again. And eventually, we found them kiting money between their corporate entities. And I filed a lawsuit against them for that. And Lon Mabon, eventually, I thought if we waited him out, he would probably lose his legal resources, which he did. And he took it up. He took up the cause himself and became his own attorney. And he decided that his legal strategy would be to claim that the judges in Oregon weren't real judges and that he wouldn't have to follow legal orders because the judges had taken the wrong oath of office. So he stopped showing up for court. And that was pretty much principally his political destruction. He was arrested in the courtroom. He was shown on television in a prison outfit, and that was pretty much it for him. I worked really strategically at this time. I made an unconventional business relationship with one of my attorneys, who was a very powerful gay man in Oregon, and I started signing over the legal fees that were awarded to me every time I won something in court directly to that attorney so that he had the ability to collect the money himself. But every single time I went to court with Lon Mabon, I would win more and more money, and he became more and more buried in this situation. Eventually, I declared victory, and I got out of the public eye because I had achieved what I needed to achieve, and I think people assumed that I had been paid, but I was never paid, which was just left a huge threat for Lon Mabon because I made it very, very clear that we would be very happy to come back if he lifted his head to do anything politically in Oregon ever again, and he hasn't. So it was effective. Scott Lively had to pay his portion when he graduated from law school, but the OCA's portion was never paid. I had to individually sue Lon Mabon and Bonnie Mabon for decisions that they made on behalf of the OCA to make them individually responsible then for the money that the OCA owed me. So that's how they became entangled in this.
You know, again, there's a critical connection between the way in which Tom Metzger with the White Aryan Resistance was essentially driven out of business by a lawsuit by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that basically took that group down. Tom Metzger was bankrupted. So there's a lot of connections here between the story of the OCA and the story of the White Aryan Resistance. I mean, these histories intersect in some critical ways, and the coalitions that fought these groups intersected in some really critical ways.
I think the one thing I want to say that's really important for this time period, there probably aren't a lot of activists that have infiltrated organizations and hate groups before. And I think it might be easier than people think. And it is an effective type of activism. I was always concerned that I would be forced into conversations that I wouldn't be able to have. Like, I literally would not be able to have a conversation about hating homosexuals with the OCA. But sort of the way these organizations work is that these conversations actually don't occur. Showing up as a witness, just taking down the most basic information, who's there, what the plan is, what the strategy is, are they potentially breaking any laws? Just the most basic information is incredibly critical to get. So there's a documentary coming out, I believe, this fall about this time period. It's about, in particular, I think it's focused on how the music scene organized around fighting ballot measure 9. It has Nirvana in it and a whole bunch of other bands that were really popular at the time. And it's made by some MTV folk. Jeff and Jennifer Crawford are making the documentary. And I think it'll be coming out relatively soon.
And so you were interviewed for that film. Do you know what the title is?
Ballot Measure 9.
We've gotten so much news recently about FBI surveillance and infiltration of environmental groups, Black Lives Matter, and other groups on the left. The left is far more often targeted for infiltration.
It's not going to be just anyone's work to infiltrate a hate group. It really isn't. And I'm not going to say it's not without its personal costs, because it is. But it's an important job. So I really encourage people. I mean, there's probably not a lot of you out there, but I encourage people to do this. It works. The important thing to understand about the OCA is the degree to which they failed. They caused a pandemonium in Oregon. It took millions of dollars, so many volunteers. Churches came out and organized against their ballot measures. People had to individually come out to their communities that they knew someone that was gay or had someone gay in their family. So that's the important thing to take away from the OCA, is how radically they failed. It completely changed Oregon. The experience of being gay really changed in Oregon and began to change nationally. It was the first anti-gay ballot measure here in Oregon, but others followed across the country, and those failed as well.
Yeah, and maybe that's an important lesson. These things don't go down on their own. We can't ever take for granted that they're going to go down on their own, and it just takes a massive battle and organizing to keep these forces down and to affirm the value of the community members that are under siege and stand in solidarity and resistance.
The one thing you want to understand about the OCA is that their intentions were clearly genocidal. Like, they triggered the Holocaust survivors for a reason. Scott Lively went on to organize in Uganda for the death penalty for homosexuals.
Right, and that just, I think, again, foregrounds the link between the fight against the OCA and the fight against the white Aryan resistance. It seems as though there's a lot of common elements between the strategy that you pursued and strategies that Antifa pursues in going after white supremacists and Nazis today. So my guest today has been Catherine Stauffer, who was instrumental in the takedown of the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the 1990s. Catherine, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Desiree.
This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Oh my God, have you seen this one?
What?
Well, scooch over, let me show it to you.
Okay,
well, what is it?
He's a politician with the love of the Lord. He's getting kickbacks from his seat on the...
That was a little bit of Pansy Division with Blame the Bible. And before that, Desiree Helligers talking with Catherine Stauffer about her work in the 1990s infiltrating the right-wing Oregon Citizens Alliance. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. You can find this show and its component parts online in a day or two via the Old Mole Variety Hour pages on the website for KBOO Portland at kboo.fm. And you can find those also by visiting, liking, following the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook, following us at Old Mole on Twitter. And we'll hear at the end of the hour from Larry Bolden and Johannes Brahms, but now we'll hear from Bill Resnick again, this time talking with organizer Don Smallman and filmmaker Marcelini Cravat about the Eco Film Festival coming up this weekend at the Hollywood Theater.
Hi, Don Smallman, who's in our studio today. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Marcelini Cravat, who's at home in Kensington, which is near Berkeley in the East Bay. Marcelini Cravat, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill, so much for taking time to talk with us.
Don Spellman is the director of the Eco Film Festival, opening this week at the Hollywood Theater.
It is Thursday the 27th through Sunday the 30th.
And you're packing in a lot of films in that period.
Yeah.
Tell us about the film festival, the Eco Film Festival.
The Portland Eco Film Festival is a four-day film festival, and we're going to this year be showing 21 films. 20 of those will be new films. We're going to be showing one repertory screening of a Werner Herzog film.
What's that one?
Oh, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Oh, why did you choose that, actually?
So there's people who enjoy environmental film festivals, but there's lots of misconceptions about environmental film festivals, I think. And so I always try to show a variety of films, not just films about climate and things that you would expect at an environmental film festival. So I try to show art films and outdoor recreation films. I show a lot of wildlife films because I think everything's connected. And so people access nature and environmental topics differently. And so I show a wide variety. And we showed the Werner Herzog film because it's the first, the oldest drawings known to man in a cave that people really aren't allowed to get into, that cave. And I love Werner Herzog. He's got a great view of nature. He's got a very unique voice about nature.
He does. Give us the whole sense of the whole festival, and then we will get to Dirt Rich.
Well, it's 4 days of film screenings. We're starting Thursday night with an opening night in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And we're showing a film called The Beaver Believers about people restoring beavers into U.S. western watersheds, and a number of short films going along with that. And then the festival is really known for pairing films with local environmental groups. So we'll have Oregon Wild with us that night. And then the next night, we're hopping over to a beautiful film made by our other guest on the show today, and it's called Dirt Rich, and it's a very interesting film about, well, I'll let the filmmaker describe it, but about how you can sequester carbon in soil to benefit both atmosphere and soil. And our partner for that night is 350 PDX, the awesome climate advocates here in town. And we go through the whole weekend with 20 films, different organizations at every screening, and we also have an opening night party, and there's just lots of ways for people to connect with these organizations and the filmmakers.
And people can learn all of this. They're not taking careful notes right now, darling.
Right.
So they can learn all of this by going to your website.
Right? Yeah, portlandecofilmfest.org, or you can also find us through the Hollywood Theater's website, too, because we are the Environmental Film Festival of the Hollywood.
Yeah, let's get to Marcelina. Marcelina Cravat, Dirt Rich is not your first environmental film. You earlier made Angel Azul. It got a lot of attention. And Dirt Rich is your second major film. Marcelina, how did you get into environmental films, and why did you do Dirt Rich? And tell us about it.
Well, I started out after film school, which I didn't go to until later on in life. And when I got out of film school, I was working with another woman, and we were making documentaries on artists, and that was what led me to my first film about a sculptor that creates statues and puts on the ocean floor. And then while we were filming that film, we started to see that the coral reefs were dying, and not the coral was not growing on his statues, so we started asking questions, and before you knew it, we were in a full-fledged environmental film mode, and we were bringing in scientists to help explain to us what was going on, and it just took on a life of its own, which is the way documentary film making seems to go for me. And while we were filming that film, I was actually back east filming Tom Garreau, who's in Dirt Rich, and he was going on and on about the carbon in the air. And then I said to him, Tom, is there any way to just like take some big machine and just suck all the carbon out of the air? And he said, actually, we have the perfect machine for that, and it's called a tree. And he turned around and pointed to a tree. And I thought that was interesting, and then he went on to start talking about biochar, which is a word I'd never heard before, and I just didn't have enough space in my brain because I was facing the edit for Angel Azul, which was a very difficult edit because I had to merge basically a science film and an art film together. So I was, you know, kind of really, I was just didn't have any room to kind of learn anything new at the time. But I put it on the back burner. And after we got partially through our festival circuit with Angel Azul, I started giving more thought to what Tom had said. And I called him up and asked him some more questions. And lo and behold, it was very clearly plain to me that the next film was going to be about this topic of pulling carbon out of the air where it does harm and put it back into the soil where it's so desperately needed.
Yeah, it's such an important part of the response to climate change. Why don't you talk about that a little? You do mostly. Are you talking about the soils and the agricultural lands? Are you also talking about reforestation and the soils in on lands that had been and should again be devoted to natural forests?
Yes, we talk about those very much so. In fact, what the film does is it takes the viewer through the strategies. It was our journey, actually. We started off with biochar and thought the film was going to be about biochar, but soon after we tackled that subject, we were able to see that there were just so many more doors to open. So what we did was we divided the film basically into four categories. We looked first at regenerative farming and agricultural techniques, which include the biochar, and we do spend quite a bit of time on the biochar because it's a really important one. In that regenerative farming and agricultural techniques, though, there are all kinds of other ones like perennial grains and polycultures and holistic grazing management, and we cover several. But then we move on to wetlands. Wetlands are the biggest carbon sink on the planet, especially marine wetlands. And that takes us into our keystone species section, which is divided. It comes up a couple times in the film. The first time it's with beavers, which is, Don had mentioned, the beaver believers. Well, we're definitely beaver believers. We just love the beavers. And in fact, where we filmed some of the beavers in Winters, California, became a place where my husband and I bought land because we were really inspired by all of the strategies that were covered in the film that we wanted to try our hand at it. And so we now have a piece of land up in Winters that we're building soil on and starting to grow things. But anyway, we do reforestation, and we go to Borneo for that. Dr. Willie Smits is extremely interesting, and we learn all about reforestation. And so those are the four categories, and they cover a lot of territory. So you have to kind of come into this film with, you know, not sleepy, because
that knowledge is absolutely essential. And reforestation as well as regenerative agriculture are such an important part of saving the planet and all the higher species, including us. When is Dirt Rich playing? Are you going to do it more than once?
It's every film plays once, except we have a repeat screening on Sunday night at 9 p.m. of whatever wins our Best Feature and Best Short Film Award. We announced that on Saturday. But we're showing Dirt Rich on Friday evening on September 28th at 6:30 p.m. And so we hope folks will come out. I'll also say about her film that, in addition to being packed with all these important and interesting ideas and techniques and people, it's just a gorgeous film to watch. It's just really like a really great kind of global ride around watching people at the forefront of figuring out, you know, new strategies for fixing things that really need to be fixed quickly. And it's just a very lush-looking, gorgeous film.
Yeah, and go to your websites for many more other films.
Yeah.
Wonderful films that people can see at the Eco Film Festival. Well, congratulations on it, Dawn, and congratulations on your film, Marcelina, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.
See you there.
Okay.
I'm a brilliant player. I had a youthful face.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was a little snippet of The Birds with Hungry Planet, recorded the year of the very first Earth Day in 1970. Before that, we heard about the Eco Film Fest coming up this weekend at the Hollywood Theater, and we turn now to book mole Larry Bolden.
Good morning. If you've not yet read Colm Tóibín, you're in for a treat. Not long ago, I reviewed his magnificent novel, Brooklyn, and today I want to talk to you about another stunning novel, Nora Webster. This is a novel that closely describes the inner workings of the mind of a woman, Nora, who, widowed in her 40s, is solely responsible for her home and her four children, two of whom still live at home. In my experience as a reader, I rarely find male authors who create believable women characters. Toyman not only creates a believable character, he goes further. He describes in great detail and in first-person narrative the stream of consciousness of a woman struggling to recreate herself as an independent person. Nora is an intensely private person, but given the small Irish town in which she lives, it is difficult to maintain even a modicum of privacy, since everyone wants and expects to know everyone else's business. Quoting from the book, "You must be fed up of them. Will they never stop coming?" Tom O'Connor, her neighbor, stood at her front door and looked at her, waiting for a response. Nora replies that they really mean well. But he goes on, "Night after night," he said, "I don't know how you put up with it." She wondered if she could get back into the house without having to answer him again. He was using a new tone with her, a tone he would never have tried before. He was speaking as though he had some authority over her. And her neighbor's not the only person who speaks to her in this new way. She finds she must return to a job she never liked and work for a man who seems to assume this paternal tone is quite justified. Quoting again, "Once again, she noted the hectoring tone as though she were a child, unable to make a proper decision. She'd tried since the funeral to ignore this tone or to tolerate it. She had tried to understand that it was shorthand for kindness." And quoting again, "In future, once the boys went to bed, she might have the house to herself more often. She would learn to spend these hours in the peace of those winter evenings. She would work out how she was going to live." Close quote. And what a fine job of it she does. She takes her family, including the two older girls, on an inexpensive caravan holiday, and slowly her children come to see the inner strength Nora has and that they can rely on her. Of course, the process is slow and often so lonely and painful, but she begins to find the joyful person she once was as she goes through the motions of working and dealing with others. The hardest part is in knowing what to say to friends, how to socialize, when in the past she had left most of that to Maurice, her more talkative and social husband. Quoting again, "At the moment, the only topic she could discuss was herself, and everyone, she felt, had heard enough about her. They believed it was time that she stop brooding and think of other things. But there were no other things. There was only what had happened. It was as though she lived underwater and had given up on the struggle to swim towards air. It would be too much. Being released into the world of others seemed impossible. It was something she did not even want. How could she explain this to anyone who sought to know how she was or ask if she was getting over what had happened?" Close quote. The profundity of this novel is not due to some sudden existential moment, some cosmic insight. Instead, it is the detailed description of how Nora copes and how she literally recreates herself. After years of not being musical, she returns to singing, and this is an important step for her in becoming. She finds a singing teacher who urges her to sing in a choir. The teacher, Lori, comments, quote, "You know I sang for Neda Bullinger." Lori continued, "and one thing she said was that singing is not something you do, it is something you live. Wasn't that wise?" Close quote. And while Nora does not know how to respond to this at the time, she does come to live her singing, and that along with the growing strength she feels in helping her children and making a new home for them allow her to emerge as a self-made person. I'll not provide more of the meticulous description Toyben uses to describe this coming to fruition of a strong and independent woman, but I hope you'll pick up the novel yourself and marvel at both Nora and Toyben. The novel is rather a long one, and there's very little dramatic action or crescendo, but I found the book to be lovely and deeply insightful. I recommend it to you along with other finely crafted books of his. I've been talking about Colm Toyben's Nora Webster. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Background, we're listening to a little of the German Requiem by Johannes Brahms, sung by Kathleen Battle. And before that, we heard bookmole Larry Bolden discussing Nora Webster, the novel by Colm Toyben. And this completes today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Kullberg, and editor, John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick, Bevan Burns, Guy Berliner, Don Smallman, Marceline Cravat, Desiree Helligers, Catherine Stauffer, Larry Bolden, and you, KBOO's listeners, members, supporters. The fall membership drive is over, but it's never too late to go to the KBOO website and click on the donate button on the upper right. Also on the KBOO website, you can find the Old Mole Variety Hour episodes and segments and more information about what's been on the show. The Mole will be back next Monday with more views, news, reviews, and interviews. Till next week, keep digging.